Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're about to hear a recording of a live radio program. It's called Indivisible. You can listen live and call in four nights a week on public radio stations around the country or at indivisibleradio.com. You can also join the conversation with hashtag IndivisibleRadio or leave us a voicemail at indivisibleradio.com. Subscribe now so you don't miss a thing. Okay, here's the show.
This is Indivisible, public radio's national conversation about America in a time of change.
From WNYC Radio, I'm Kai Wright. Good evening.
And I'm John Prideaux from The Economist. It's Monday night. That means a couple of things for Indivisible. First, we're trying to give a sense of what this moment in American politics looks like to those outside the US, and in particular to America's allies around the world.
And second, on Mondays, we're asking you to join the conversation by sharing your own life experiences. We're less interested in your opinion than we are your story. But tonight, we're going to need to kind of blend those things up a bit, because the big question facing the Trump administration right now is its approach to national security. And we want to hear from Trump voters about how he's doing on this front. Earlier today, the president announced he's chosen Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster to be his next national security advisor, a choice that's gone over pretty well so far. But last week was plainly a bumpy one for the president, no matter how much he insists otherwise.
This administration is running like a fine-tuned machine.
It could use some more tuning. First, there was the chaos and the negative court rulings on the president's travel ban. And then Michael Flynn was caught talking with Russian officials about U.S. sanctions before Trump took office, which is potentially a federal crime. And then retired Vice Admiral Robert Harward made matters worse for the administration when he refused to take over Flynn's job, reportedly because he wasn't given full authority over his staffing. And, of course, there was that Thursday press conference, a long and combative spectacle in which the president didn't even feign concern about Flynn's freelance diplomacy. When asked whether he directed Flynn to talk to the Russians about sanctions, Trump said,
"Mike was doing his job. He was calling countries and his counterparts. So it certainly would have been okay with me if he did it. I would have directed him to do it if I thought he wasn't doing it. I didn't direct him, but I would have directed him because that's his job."
Except Flynn didn't hold the job yet, and Trump wasn't yet president, which is the potentially illegal part. And then the rally in Florida this weekend, where Trump seemed to announce a terrorist incident in Sweden, which was news to the Swedes.
You look at what's happening last night in Sweden. Sweden. Who would believe this? Sweden. They took in large numbers. They're having problems like they never thought possible.
Turns out he was talking about a Fox News story on Swedish immigration, which aired the previous night, not a terrorist incident. Well, today, finally, the president had some good news with Lieutenant General McMaster, but the Flynn debacle and all that followed it have reinforced fears that the president of the United States is simply not in control of things, which begs the question of whether we will play a stabilizing role in the world or a massively disruptive one. So, with all of that, if you voted for Donald Trump based primarily on national security, we want to hear from you tonight. What specifically did he promise as a candidate that comforted you about our national security? And how do you feel about that thing now, having watched him operate for about a month? Call us at 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255 and tell us about it. Again, Trump voters who were motivated primarily by national security issues. Do you still believe he's got a handle on our country's security? If so, which of his moves specifically have comforted you? Or have you been shaken by recent events? And to be clear, that doesn't mean you have to no longer support him. We can have a nuanced conversation here. But if you were a Trump voter and you're now worried about any of these national security developments, which ones? What's concerned you and why? Call us at 844-745-TALK. That's 844-8255. Or tweet us using the hashtag IndivisibleRadio. And while your calls are coming in, John, related to all of this, there was quite a scene at a global security conference in Munich, Germany last week and over the weekend. Take us there. What was going on in Munich and why should our listeners care about it?
Yeah, that's right, Kai. So earlier today, I spoke to Edward Lucas, who writes for The Economist and was there in Munich. This is a meeting, the Munich Security conference that's been taking place annually for the past 50 years. And normally, American officials turn up and make speeches about the strength of the transatlantic alliance. This year, the Vice President Mike Pence and the Defense Secretary James Mattis sort of had a repair job to do, reassuring nervous allies. And according to Edward, it was not entirely successful.
Mike Pence's speech was quite artfully crafted, and he had a lot of phrases like, the president has asked me to come here, the president wants me to say, the president strongly believes that. But in a way, the more he talked about the president, the more we remembered what the president is really like.
So the problem the Vice President and the Defence Secretary had in Munich was that foreign allies and adversaries have noticed that this administration does not speak with one voice, and that soothing words from one member of the president's administration can be quickly undone by the president himself.
I think he's realised that publicly dissing allies doesn't get him anywhere. And we've seen very friendly, effusively friendly visits from Japan, which is America's most important ally in Asia, and from Canada, which is America's most important neighbouring ally. And so it's clear that the president can play nice when he wants to, but it's not at all clear that he's actually changed his internal convictions, which are very strongly America first. I think people fear that the president really isn't capable of changing his mind. These are deeply held convictions. It would require an earthquake in order for him to start seeing the world in the way that previous American presidents have seen it.
In the absence of such an earthquake, one of the things that foreigners are watching closely is who has the president's ear on national security. Joining us now to talk about some of this is Karen DeYoung, who's senior national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Hi, Karen.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Let's start with the news. President Trump's picked Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster as his national security advisor. What can you tell us about him?
Well, he's known as a warrior scholar, an intellectual. He has in addition to graduating from West Point, he has a doctorate in military history. He's probably best known for a book that he wrote in the late 1990s called Dereliction of Duty. And it took the question of kind of who lost Vietnam, which in the military at least has for a long time been answered by the thought that the politicians at the time, President Johnson and others, kind of wimped out, that they wouldn't do what the military told them was necessary to win. And what he says in this book was that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the heads of the various service divisions, in fact were complicit in this, that they did not push back, that they pretty much agreed with the politicians, and that they were just as responsible for the loss of the war as the politicians were. He did lots of things after that. He was in the Gulf War, where he was known for a 2005 operation in the northwestern Iraqi town of Tal Afar, where he first, I think it's generally looked at as the first use of what they called the COIN strategy, counterinsurgency strategy, where instead of the U.S. military going into places where they were fighting and then going back to their bases at night, actually moving in and trying to win hearts and minds and convincing people that they were there to protect them 24 hours a day. And this, of course, became the basis of the COIN strategy that General Petraeus used to great effect a couple of years later. He then went on to Afghanistan, where he wrote a very well-regarded anti-corruption report. Big Task Force looked at not only the corruption among Afghans who were dealing with the U.S. military, but in the military itself, which everybody knew was going on and nobody really wanted to talk about that much. Most recently, he's been stateside doing kind of intellectual tasks, looking forward to what direction the military should go in, what kind of training they should have, what kind of equipment they should have, what their doctrines should be. A couple years ago, he wrote a study on Ukraine that looked at the Russian military operations there in eastern Ukraine and in Crimea, and basically concluded that the Russians were moving way ahead of the military in the U.S. military in their conventional capabilities. That while the United States was kind of diverted and obsessed with counterterrorism in the Middle East, that in fact the Russians were building better tanks, that they were building better conventional weapons that they had tested and used to great effect in Ukraine. And so he's a, you know, he's kind of, on the one hand, a warrior's warrior, known for being outspoken, but also a strategist.
So, Karen, there's some superficial resemblance with Mike Flynn, who, you know, the outgoing NSA, in the sense that he's another lieutenant general. He made his name in counterinsurgency, if you like, in Vietnam. But he's a less political figure than General Flynn, right? He's not somebody who was attached to Donald Trump in the campaign. You'd expect him to give more independent, perhaps less politicized advice. Is that fair?
Well, he's also an active duty officer at the moment, which is different from General Flynn, who retired several years ago. And I think General Flynn was primarily in intelligence in the latter years of his career and had, as you know, been the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, where his leadership skills of a large organization ran into problems. And I think that General McMaster has not had those kind of problems. He's very well regarded as somebody you can talk to, has a sense of humor. I think all in all, you'll get pretty good reviews of him, which was not necessarily the case with General Flynn. He'd made some, I won't say enemies, but he had run into problems in terms of personnel skills that didn't stand him in very good stead when he joined the Trump campaign and subsequently joined the administration.
You're listening to Indivisible. We're talking to Karen DeYoung, senior national security correspondent for The Washington Post, and we're taking calls from Trump voters who voted primarily based on national security. James in Brooklyn, you are on the air. How are you doing, James?
Good. How are you?
I'm well. Tell us about why you voted for Trump and how you feel about it now.
I voted for Trump, honestly, because I didn't really think that they were all that much different, Trump or Hillary. And I don't really feel as if Trump at this point is very much different than Barack Obama was on national security. I feel like it's a wash, and I don't feel like Barack Obama is all that much different than George W. Bush on national security. So I believe, like, this frame that's kind of, like, perpetuating through the media is kind of incorrect. They're all the same to me.
So, James, if that's the case, then why Trump? If they were all the same, what is it, what specifically did Trump say or what has he done that you think is better on national security if they're all the same?
No, I didn't vote for him because he was better on national security. I believed that they would be the same on that issue.
Okay, well, thank you, James. Karen, what do you think about that? What about this idea that there's no difference between Trump and Hillary and Barack Obama before them and Bush before them on national security? They're all the same thing. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that you could say that where George Bush and Barack Obama come up was kind of the same in the sense that, Obama got elected in part by saying he was going to end the wars in the Middle East, and that didn't happen. I mean, he withdrew the troops from Iraq and then had to send them back, obviously a much smaller number, but it's been growing. And similarly in Afghanistan, you know, there's still 10,000 troops there. I think that the difference between Trump and Hillary Clinton is I think that President Trump made very clear in the campaign that what he cared about was the counter-Islamic State campaign. And he said many, many times that terrorism was the biggest problem that we faced, that Obama had been weak on terrorism, that everything else was a secondary concern. Russia was a secondary concern, even though General Mattis, who's now his defense secretary, has testified and said many times that he considers Russia to be the biggest threat. He just made very clear that he wasn't that concerned. He wasn't that concerned about Ukraine. He was concerned about China, not so much from a military point of view, but more from an economic point of view. And so he focused on counterterrorism, that was the biggest threat and that everything else was secondary to that priority.
Yeah, and I think we have a call, Sam in Philly, who also is concerned, who voted for Trump based on this. Sam in Philly, you're on the air?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Perfect.
I gather you voted for Trump based on your concern about terrorism. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Tell us about that. What did he specifically say that comforted you, and how do you feel now after a month in office about that thing?
So I think he does a really good job. I think I voted for him because he was the only one who kind of got rid of the political correctness of not mentioning that the major conflict of the terrorism and the major conflicts of the world in general are sparked by Islamic terrorism. I'm personally a religious Jew, and, you know, I lived in Israel, and I you know, lived through this daily terrorism on a daily basis. So it's coming, you know, more and more to Europe. I'm also from Europe. I'm from Germany. And my parents tell me about what's going on there with the many, many refugees, that, you know, so many incidences will be not even being discussed in the national and international media. So I think by Trump calling it what it is, that it's terrorism that's growing within particular pockets in Islamic societies, is, I think, the right way. I think Obama went the opposite of saying that let's not call it anything so that it doesn't grow bigger. And the interesting thing is it grew actually bigger over those many, many years. I'm not sure if this kind of makes sense, but that's basically the approach that I took while I voted for Trump.
So, Karen, thank you for that, Sam. Karen, on this notion, this was certainly a big part of the critique of Barack Obama, is his willingness to call it what it is. And that actually seems like it's kind of faded from our political conversation right now. Help us understand that. How big a deal was it? Where does this issue stand in our conversation now?
Well, you know, President Obama made a point of not calling this Islamic extremism. He called it violent extremism and pointed out that it took many forms and that it was a minority in the Muslim world, and that in fact we needed our friends in the Muslim world to combat it. Obviously, President Trump during the campaign made a big point of saying you have to call it what it is, radical Islamic extremism. I'm not sure at this point that makes a whole lot of difference to the perpetrators of the violence. Some would argue and have argued that by kind of branding a religion the basis of terrorism, that you probably make more enemies than you would otherwise. I think the thing with President Trump is we know what he said during the campaign, and we don't know for sure yet what he's going to actually do. He has ordered the military and the other national security agencies to come up with a new plan to fight the Islamic State, primarily in Iraq and Syria, but globally also. I'm not sure at this point overseas, this is not to talk about the immigration issue, but I'm not totally sure at this point what more is going to be done. I think there probably will be a few more troops in Syria. I think some of the rules of engagement will be loosened. But I'm not quite sure where that's going to take us.
Let me interrupt you there. We've got to take a short break. We're listening to Indivisible. We're talking to Karen DeYoung, senior national security correspondent for The Washington Post, and taking your calls. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. Or tweet us using hashtag Indivisible Radio. Stay with us.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, ones tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. available wherever you get podcasts.
This is Indivisible, Public Radio's national conversation about America in a time of change.
From WNYC Radio, I'm Kai Wright.
And I'm John Prudhoe from The Economist.
We're talking with The Washington Post senior national security correspondent Karen DeYoung about the Trump administration's eventful past week as he tries to put together a national security and foreign policy staff. And we're taking calls from people who voted for Trump primarily based on national security. Let us know, what specifically did he promise that comforted you, and how do you feel about that thing now, 1 month into his presidency? Call us at 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. Trump voters who were primarily concerned about national security, what did you want to see from him? How do you feel like it's gone now? 844-745-TALK. 844-745-8255, or tweet us using the hashtag Indivisible.
So, Karen, the president has filled this key post. He now has a national security advisor, but there's still plenty of vacancies in the Trump White House, and particularly in the areas of, foreign policy and national security. And, you know, at issue here, you've got the fact that so many Republicans who have national security and foreign policy experience declared their opposition to Donald Trump during the campaign. How do you think that's going to play out now? Does the president relent and allow some of the people who opposed him to come into the administration at lower levels? Or does the administration end up filled with people with little experience?
Yeah, you've got in the actual NSC, where there are about, give or take, 20 people in either direction, you've got about 200 people who do policy. They're divided into regional directorates, issue directorates. And of those 200, give or take, about 75 or 80 are White House hires. They are people that the White House goes out and gets. Most of those jobs have been filled. The rest of them are people who are detailees from other agencies, from the Defense Department, from the intelligence community, from the State Department. Those are usually jobs that rotate every 2 years. Some of those jobs aren't filled yet. I think there are several dozen of them that haven't been filled. So the question is not the staff at the National Security Council. I think it's more the staff in the departments. At the State Department, you've got most of the jobs immediately below the secretary are not filled. You don't have a deputy secretary of state. You don't have, I think you had a sort of temporary undersecretary for political affairs who's now been made the acting deputy. So that job is empty again. Assistant secretaries, which are political appointees who have to be confirmed by Congress, you had most of those were asked to leave. They handle the regions of the world and different issues, nonproliferation, democracy, human rights. And similarly, in the Defense Department, you have a lot of vacant jobs. So you've got really several thousand jobs that are not filled. Many of them require congressional confirmation, and that's going to take a long time to do. The problem also in the NSC is that there aren't real clear lines of authority in the White House. You've got a number of people, Steve Bannon, Steve Miller, Reince Priebus, who Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, who have some role in national security policy, but it's not really clear what that role is right now. And I think one of the problems, excuse me, with Mike Flynn was that he did not really know kind of where he stood among these other people. And one of the things you mentioned in your introduction that General Harward, who was the first choice to replace Flynn, had turned the job down largely because it wasn't clear that he would be able to choose his own people underneath him. These 200 people, do the ones that General Flynn hired get to stay? Some of them,
it was a proxy fight over control, right? I mean, was it over,
right.
whether the political appointees are the staff would be the front line on security questions? Is that
well? And I think
understand?
Too, yes, you had that, but you also have, you know, what is the role of the National Security Advisor? The National Security Advisor is the president's in-house advisor on national security policy, but is also the coordinator among all the other members of the National Security Council. And the members traditionally are the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and people who have a senior role outside of the White House in national security. And so his job was to make sure that everyone's views were represented, to make sure that they came together in a coherent series of options for the president to make a decision about. And I think the combination of not being in control of national security policy in the White House and really not having the national security departments and agencies really up to speed and filled with people who can advise what are really pretty inexperienced secretaries who haven't had these kind of jobs before, left them a bit adrift and not getting along too well with each other.
Let me bring in some callers here to this, Karen. David in Alexandria, Virginia. David, you're on the air.
Yes. So the conversation has been really interesting. I've had the fortune of serving under both Lieutenant General Flynn and General McMaster in Afghanistan several years ago. I mean, I think they're both geniuses. I think they're an amazing choice, and I look forward to watching what happens because I think that General McMaster is more than capable for this position.
And how do you feel on this question about who's calling the shots on the National Security Council? How much of it is political appointees versus someone like McMaster?
It was an interesting comment because honestly, I don't think. I agree with the speaker that that Lieutenant General Flynn ran into problems inside the senior levels of the White House, and I think that General McMaster is not going to shy away from having the same conversation. So I don't know that it's going to be interesting to see what happens if General McMaster goes the way of General Flynn.
So you feel like, based on your time with him, that he's going to be a rabble razzle within the White House.
He is absolutely 100% not afraid to speak his mind and make it very clear how he feels about any given topic, and he has no fear expressing that, as did Lieutenant General Flynn.
Thank you for that, David. Karen, what's the road forward then? Is that, you know, I mean, because on one hand, that what David's saying really might comfort a lot of the sort of traditional national security Republicans who have been put at unease by things coming out of the Trump White House. Is that?
Well, I think it's important that, and this was stated by Reince Priebus, it was stated by the White House spokesperson, that General McMaster will be able to choose his own staff. One of the questions that came up after General Flynn left was whether the Deputy National Security Advisor, K.T. McFarlane, would stay in her job, and the White House said, yes, she will. I think that it'll be interesting to see if she does stay in that job when General McMaster comes along. I think he has a reputation for speaking truth to power. He's not a shrinking violet at all, but at the same time, he's not known as an ideologue in quite the way that General Flynn had come to be known as something of an ideologue certainly since he retired from the military. I think his experience is broader. It's interesting to me that President Trump feels so comfortable around military officers. We now have the defense secretary is a retired four-star general. The head of Homeland Security is a retired four-star general. The candidates, with one exception, and that was John Bolton, to replace General Flynn, were all either active duty or retired military officers. And that's something that, on the one hand, I think that it's a little bit a product of when they've been interviewed by President Trump, these guys give a great interview. They speak clearly. They've learned this their whole lives. They
They're
know
military
how to
men. They know how to talk
to
a guy. Right?
They're really good at it. But I do think you saw the statement that John McCain put out where he said General McMaster is an outstanding choice. He's well known on Capitol Hill. He's well respected. I think the question will be, is he going to find this a job where he is able to do the job the way he understands the job to be? Is he going to run into problems, in a sense, the same kind of problems that General Flynn ran into? But I think that General Flynn's position, having been on the campaign and having been very, very outspoken in political terms, didn't really serve him very well in that job.
Let's get some more callers in. Bessie from Chicago. Hi, Bessie. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Hey, Sam. Hey, Karen.
Hey.
Glad to be on.
So, tell us about your experience, Bessie.
Current military law enforcement, did vote for Trump. I've had some recent concerns with him as of late. I would say there's definitely certain things I would agree with, certain things I would disagree with, and as there's definitely pros and cons the way he communicates, the way he presents himself.
But do you voted for him based on national security, I gather?
Yes, that'd be a primary reason.
And so in this month, is it what specifically has either concerned you or not concerned you?
A definite concern, it was definitely a concern probably since he announced his nomination, was just his irrationality and just how unpredictable he can be, which can be, I guess, a pro to any enemies of the state, because you can never really predict or really gather some sort of large sample size of data of what he may do next. But, of course, a very, very con side to that is that with a man with his hands on the nuclear codes, that's just a great amount of responsibility that you wouldn't exactly want to be on a whim on a certain, what may be his mood of the day or what irrational outburst he may have, which would be a definite concern of mine.
Thanks for that, Bessie. Karen, what about that irrationality and unpredictability? How does that play in sort of intelligence circles?
Well, you saw last week with General Mattis, the Defense Secretary, and Vice President Pence traveling in Europe, in Brussels, speaking to the G20, speaking to NATO, and finally speaking to the Munich Security Conference, this big gathering where leaders from all over Europe and the States come every year, where they were kind of cleaning up, reassuring allies, kind of saying, don't, pay no attention to the guy behind the curtain. And I think that there's some reason to believe that. You look at, for example, on the torture question, where you had Trump saying a lot of things during the campaign, and then you had General Mattis saying, well, I don't believe in torture. And then Trump, very quickly, President Trump said, well, he's my general. I'm going to go with him. And I think that this is one of the problems of not having this coordination set up yet through the National Security Council. There is no system at the moment for kind of vetting ideas, kind of letting everybody have their say, regardless of what the president says in public. I think you've seen some evidence that the people around him, as many had hoped, are, softening the edges, are reassuring allies. But there's no process to do that now. And so you've got them going out on the road, and you had Vice President Pence today talking to the EU, saying we're all set for cooperation and partnership. We have a steadfast and enduring relationship. Where you had President Trump on the campaign last year saying that Brussels was a hellhole, he called it, that you can't trust any of these people, yeah. Indicating he didn't care about it. And so I think that once we get the system for vetting policy and strategy in place, hopefully it'll be a little smoother.
Karen, listening to what John McCain and some others have been saying about Lieutenant General McMaster, it seems like there's a lot to like about him in terms of experience, temperament, and so on. But what's the potential downside to having somebody fresh out of the military as National Security Advisor?
Well, I guess it would be that, foreign policy and national security is much more than military power. It's diplomacy, it's economic policy, and if you've had someone looking at something through the relatively narrow lens of the military, then you say, I forget the metaphor about the hammer and the nail, but, everything looks
like a military
problem. Yeah. But I do think that General McMaster, because he has been, he is an intellectual. He is a student of military history, at least. And so I think that he's someone who there's some confidence that he at least is very aware of the breadth of what goes into making a national security policy. So I think that's sort of the hope here.
Karen, we're getting a little short on time, but because we have you, I want to ask you a question that is, I think, confusing to a lot of people, and that's this question around the leaks and the leakers' relationship to the press and, as you know, the president has said, the enemies of the state piece. Setting aside that phrasing, which is, troubling and triggering, trying to parse the sort of underlying assertion that he's making there, is there something in all of these years you've been covering national security, is there something special about the leaking that's happening now? And is it in fact something we should be concerned about? A too cozy relationship between intelligence and the press has not always been good. See, under the run-up to the Iraq War. And so how do we think about this?
Leaks, if you want to call them leaks, are not specific to this administration. I think it's been telescoped a bit in time, more than you would have in other administrations. Certainly, President Obama was very upset about leaks and launched more investigations and prosecuted more people than I think all of his predecessors combined. Mm-hmm. The difference, I don't think there is a difference necessarily in the quantity or the quality of the leaks. There certainly is a difference in the way that President Trump has chosen to address it, and to essentially blame the news media for doing our jobs. We're working. That's what we do. And I think that different people talk to reporters for all kinds of different reasons, and it's our job to filter through that and to decide what someone's motivation is and to check it from every direction that we can and decide how legitimate it is, both in substance and tone, and that's all we can do is continue doing our job.
But quickly, what's coming at you doesn't there's not more of it coming out of the White House or coming out of government than you've seen in the past.
I really don't think so. I think it's a little bit compressed in time. Well, I think you always find at the beginning of an administration, as they try to get organized, that a lot of people are unhappy because they either like the way things used to be or they expected something different.
We'll have to leave it there, Karen. I'll take it as no, there's no difference. But thanks for that. Thanks for joining us, Karen DeYoung from The Washington Post.
You're
after the break,
welcome.
We will take your calls about President's Day. Stay with us.
This is Indivisible, Public Radio's national conversation about America in a time of change.
From WNYC Radio, I'm Kai Wright.
And I'm John Prideaux from The Economist.
It's President's Day today, and on Indivisible all this week, we'll be touching on how presidents shape the story of our country.
And tonight we want to talk about the stories we tell ourselves and others about America. So listeners, we want to hear from you. What's important to you about the founding, the ideals of this country? Call us at 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. And as your calls are coming in, Kai, I want to ask you this question. What's your answer to this? When you think about America, your idea of the country, you know, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Well, I have to tell you, John, I'm a Black American whose parents grew up unable to do things like walk through the front door of hotels and, you know, vote in some places. So, quite frankly, America's story is inseparable from slavery and genocide to me. But there's also this radical idea, at least, of democracy and equality among people. And that's obviously important, too. So I guess for me, America's story is the gap between our ideals and our realities. And the process of closing that gap with all of the remarkable tools we've been given, you know, our free press, the right to organize, the vote, all those tools of democracy and constantly defending them. That's kind of my story. What about you?
Well, I have a sort of insider-outsider relationship with America. I'm not a U.S. citizen, but my younger son, who was born in Washington, D.C., is. And when I lived in D.C., my other son, who's British, used to insist on listening to a rock version of the Star Spangled Banner every day at breakfast time. So he was kind of more enthusiastic about America than most Americans actually are. But I, as a journalist writing about America, which is my day job, the constant theme is the one you mentioned, really. This gap between the ideals, which are noble and timeless, and the reality, which can be disappointing, but, you know, also sometimes uplifting to report on.
Well, we're also joined by Harvard historian and New York staff writer Jill Lepore. Hi, Jill. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for being with us.
Sure.
So, Jill, you've written a bit about American myths, the stories we tell ourselves, which may not literally be true, but that capture something essential about the country. Just thinking about outside the country for a minute, for a lot of people in the West, you know, America's always seemed a bit like an elder brother who looks out for its less powerful siblings in the playground. But Jill, that idea, you know, of the country that stands up for a set of universal values around the world, you know, liberty, democracy, is kind of a recent one, isn't it? I mean, Dean Rusk said that if you scratch an American, you'll find an isolationist.
I don't know. I mean, it certainly goes back to the Atlantic Charter with Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, and I don't think that was mythical. I think that was rhetorical, but in the best sense of rhetoric, I think it was kind of soaring oratory. So what you two speaking about found the upside of the idea of America, the aspirations, that sense of idealism, that is really longstanding, and you can trace that in American political rhetoric all the way back to the founding of the colonies.
So, Jill, respond to Kai for a minute. He
the counter-tradition sees of political dissent.
I'm sorry. We lost you for a second.
Go ahead and finish your thought, Jill.
Yeah, I was just saying I find equally inspiring the tradition of political dissent. So just thinking about what Kai was saying about what does and does not meet the expectations when those ideals aren't realized. I mean, you think about Malcolm X saying, "We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us." And that rhetorical move in African-American political dissent rhetoric goes all the way back. I mean, Frederick Douglass, in his speech about the 4th of July in 1852, saying to a white audience, "The 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, but I must mourn." I mean, there's this incredible soaring power both to the ideals of freedom and equality that are the national truths, these truths that we hold self-evident, that we have to fight for the truth of. And then the people who fight for that truth in the way they speak to that, I just find so in some ways much worthier.
We're joined by Harvard historian and New York staff writer Jill Lepore. We're talking about President's Day and the story of the country, the story we tell ourselves. Call us and tell us about the story that you tell yourself about America. 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. And I am going to bring in some callers here. So, Raina in Exeter, New Hampshire. Raina, how are you? You're on
Hi,
the air.
Hi, it's Raina. I'm well. How are you?
Raina is how you pronounce it?
Yes.
I'm sorry about that. Tell us about your story, Raina.
I feel so strongly about the whole concept of religious freedom and in the founding of our country. And it and also the freedom to not be religious. And it just feels to me that that world is closing in all the time, and that there are only one or maybe two types of acceptable religions. And that just doesn't seem like the principle that our country was founded on. We weren't founded as a Christian nation.
Raina, why do you think that story is so important to you? Why is that the one that sort of stands out for you personally as what's important about America?
I guess because I have friends of so many different beliefs, and I always feel that either for myself or for them, that somebody's getting excluded when we cordon off what's acceptable, you know, whether, you know, believing in Allah or not believing in God at all, or believing in Jesus as the Savior, whether or not any of those are acceptable to our government. That just, to me, shouldn't even be a question. Having to put your hand on a Bible to accept your office in the government seems like such a mixed message to me.
Well, thank you for that, Raina. I want to move to Alex in Minneapolis. Alex, hi, you're on the air with Indivisible.
Hi, I'm really glad to be on. I really like you guys' show.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, the question is, what does America mean to me?
Yeah.
Correct? Yeah, to me, it's always just been an imperfect project. America is imperfect at its core. We've never been perfect. And so for me, it's just this continuous improvement that is America, trying to figure out a better way to govern, a better way to treat each other, a better way to live. And it just lately, it just feels like the problems all are arising for people who just assume that they know, or that their beliefs are fast and concrete, and that there's no room for improvement. You know, when you decide that you don't know stuff, you're able to learn more about other people, other cultures, about your American culture, and therefore make a more perfect union.
Thanks, Alex. I like that idea of America as kind of continuous improvement. And Jill, it gets to me anyway, one of the great American ideas, which is a profound sort of optimism that frankly can border on the naive at times, but which you wouldn't want to be without, I think. And yet during the campaign, Donald Trump spent a lot of time painting a bleak picture of America. It used to be a political cliche that the most optimistic candidate was the one who always won, but not this time. Did the president tap in some other more kind of pessimistic American myth?
Oh, Jill, I think we've lost Jill. Okay, well,
I think the technology has failed us, Kai. Maybe I should ask that question of you then. I mean, did you share my feeling? I've thought just watching this campaign, one of the reasons I have to confess I didn't think Donald Trump would win was I had always read that the most Reagan-like sunny morning in America candidate was the one, you know, most in tune with the national mood, and that to go against that was somehow sort of, you know, against the country's DNA.
It's
and I
really
was dead wrong.
It's really remarkable. And you know, and the same thing could have been said in some ways of Hillary Clinton's campaign. You know, it was so focused on the dangers of Donald Trump. Nobody in the campaign was telling a story of this American optimism you're talking about, which is a really unique thing for an American presidential election. I think we have Jill back. Jill, are you with us?
I am, yeah. And can I jump in and say something about Raina's comment earlier, which I found
Go for
so
it.
Interesting? Yeah. I mean, one of the things historically that's really important to remember is that our tolerance for difference in political beliefs comes from a tolerance for difference in religious beliefs. I mean, that's where the idea of tolerance comes from. It comes from the English Civil War and this centuries of fights over religion in Europe that led to this lesson that, you know what, it was actually a good thing for everybody to tolerate different religious beliefs. And that creates and makes possible a kind of commitment to political tolerance that's part of the founding ideology of the United States. So it is heartbreaking to see that flip back around. Yeah.
Can we also quickly, Jill, put to you the question that John was asking when we lost you, which is, it seems like there was we're so invested in this narrative of optimism for America, and yet Donald Trump seemed to tap into something totally different with what was felt like a pessimistic campaign. What is he tapping into there?
Yeah, it's really hard to go back and read through, say, inaugural addresses, which I once did. I sat and read them all, and find an inaugural address that isn't fundamentally characterized by idealism, not necessarily by optimism, but by idealism. Right? These are the ideas that we hold dear, and here's the struggle that we're going to fight to realize those ideals. Here are our challenges. Maybe there are some dark clouds in the horizon. Maybe we're even in the middle of a storm, but there's this, you know, that's just the way the rhetoric works. So it was really jarring to hear a Trump's speech because of it really so much for me wasn't the lack of optimism. It was just the utter bleakness, the utter absence of a sense that there is, that we do share a set of ideas.
But was there anything precedented in America's sort of presidential narrative for that? That for sort of as the president is the spokesperson for the American idea, is there a precedent for that?
The president has always been the spokesperson for. I mean, that, you know, there's no reason to give an inaugural address except that George Washington gave one after he was inaugurated. He thought it would be a good idea and spoke to Congress and sort of laid out his vision. And Jackson then started speaking to the American people, and now we speak to the American people immediately through digital means. But what the president usually does is talk about the Constitution. Especially in the 19th century, presidents talked about the Constitution, but you can't go. Trump, I don't think, even mentioned the Constitution. Now, partly what the speech has to do, because the oath of office is an oath to pledge a pledge to the Constitution, that's what the speech really is meant to deliver on. So it didn't deliver on that either.
So let's get back to some callers here. Nadia in Sacramento, California. Nadia, hello, and welcome to Indivisible. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. So the question was, it's about America.
what is your idea of the American story? What does it mean to you personally?
Well, my family immigrated here in the 80s from Yemen. And so America to me has always been basically the land of opportunity and just a summation of all these immigrants coming together in trying to make a country that functions the way that everybody thinks a country should function. And it's been imperfect, and it still is, but I still have this optimism that America's the land of immigrants, the land of opportunity, and just the land of all of these ideals of what a country should be like.
Despite the message currently of...
Well, it's, you know, it's hard. But I'm, you know, that displays only half of the voter population of America. And even within that voter population, not everybody necessarily believes that, or they claim not to believe that. So I'm still trying to stay optimistic. I think there's just a lot of misinformation. And when you're fed information that isn't true and believe it, it's easy to just run with it.
Well, thank you, Nadia. Let's go to James in Silver Springs, Maryland. James, you're on the air. Welcome to Indivisible.
I'm a person who is terribly enthused by the bequest that our founding fathers have left us. They built a constitution that works, but it was morally flawed. It said that slaves were three-fifths of a person or whatever. It said slavery was the law of the land initially. But they also gave us the Declaration of Independence, which was not quite consistent entirely with the Constitution, but gives us an aspirational diagram for the future. And I think we should go to the preamble of the Constitution and read it. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I look forward to the day when every talk show, when every piece of legislation, when every public policy is put up against the equality, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness aspirational standards of the Declaration of Independence. And I think we could all gain immediately by talking about the Declaration every time something comes up and deciding that really important laws like slavery, for example, fails. Equality? My God. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness.
James.
All of those things were totally repressed under slavery. If we had really implemented or aspired to implement our Declaration of Independence, we could have all agreed to get rid of the slavery without the Civil War.
James, thank you very much for that. You have brought the Declaration of Independence to this conversation in this talk show. Jill, what about that? So the Declaration of Independence as our founding idea, is this something that presidents talk about a lot? Is it how does this actually genuinely shape our sort of presidential messages?
Well, people often combine the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution as if they're a single document, and that's the legacy of what historians call the constitutionalization of the Declaration of Independence. That's what Abraham Lincoln accomplishes. It's Lincoln who says, okay, the Constitution condones slavery, exactly as James was saying, but the Declaration of Independence can be used to undo that. It's a pledge to the future. It's a promise that we can use to undo what the Constitution has done. And so there's this incredible turn in the meaning of the Declaration of Independence during the Civil War. And it does have that kind of founding creed nature to it, but it's nevertheless controversial and is fought over, and is fought over by each generation. When I think about the American Bicentennial in the 1970s, celebrating the 200th anniversary of the American Revolution, I remember in Boston in 1773, the 200th anniversary of the dumping of the tea, the Boston Tea Party, there was a ship made in Europe, and it's about a fake 18th century ship that was sailed across the ocean, and it was going to be this big deal when it reached Boston. There was going to be a reenactment of the Tea Party, and a lot of people were really excited about that and had this kind of storybook version of the Tea Party, and went to Boston only to find that the whole thing was mobbed with protesters. There was a huge Vietnam Veterans Against the War protest that day, that people who saw themselves, that these Vietnam veterans who were protesting the war, they were the true inheritors of the American revolutionary tradition. There was an American Indian movement protest. There were all these people in Nixon masks running around. And the whole thing kind of came unraveled. And I think that for a lot of people who feel maybe betrayed by the current, the sort of previous regime of the reign of Obama, that there's some sense of the unraveling of a consensus around the American past that really fell apart in the 1970s.
Well, Jill, we're going to have to wrap up the conversation there. That's Jill Lepore, a staff writer from the New Yorker, a Harvard historian, and the author of many books. Thanks for joining us, Jill.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Indivisible. This is Public Radio's national conversation, airing four nights a week for the first 100 days of the new administration. Tomorrow on Indivisible, President's Week continues as presidential historian Douglas Brinkley and political commentator Cokie Roberts join WNYC host Brian Lehrer for a history lesson on how the definition of democracy has evolved through 45 American presidents. I'm Kai Wright.
And I'm John Prideaux.
Thanks for listening, and talk to you next week.
If you like the Indivisible podcast, rate and review it and tell your friends. And thanks for listening.